Bandwidth for the Weird Things podcast provided by WiredTree. For sites of any size and world-class customer service, head on over to WiredTree.com.
Just begin right now because Brian's got a face full of food.
All right, now I'm ready.
Welcome to After Things. I'm Andrew Main, joined by Brian Brushwood.
Heck yeah.
And Justin Robert Young.
Pow, pow.
I was not really actually trying to catch you, Brian, as you ate. I just said, because last one I'm like, oh, I introduced Justin first. Now I'll introduce you.
No, no, no. That's fine.
And drink.
Look, I was prepared either way. I knew the risk when I lifted up the drink to my mouth.
So, we left off on Weird Things. We wanted to talk a little bit about Avengers Age of Ultron, and maybe we'll try to draw some helpful illustrative observations that you can use in your own life.
Well, it seems like one of the running threads in the After Things is sort of, pulling back the curtain about the actual mechanics behind a lot of entertainment and making artistic projects. It seems like there's a fascinating case study happening with Avengers Age of Ultron and what appears very much to be a frustrated Joss Whedon behind the scenes. And of course, when there's lots of money on the line, there's things you could say and there's things you don't mind saying and chances you take. And I think some of the quotes he had said was that he made more money on Dr. Horrible's sing-along blog than he made from Avengers, and that he's frustrated and having a difficult time with Disney / Marvel. And then on top of all that, he goes and deletes his entire Twitter account, which I believe he hasn't reinstituted, has he?
Not yet, no.
Not yet.
So what can you read in the tea leaves of all of this? And what lessons could somebody who wants to be in that kind of position take from it?
And let's start off by saying that I'm gonna assume we are all fans.
Yeah.
We are all fans of his, and you see a guy who is an extremely talented writer. This is a guy that created Buffy the Vampire Slayer, okay, created one of the most beloved film or series, and he wrote the film of that type of genre, really put forth the idea of a strong heroine, a kick-ass female character.
He wrote Toy Story.
Oh yeah, he did. Yeah, one of the main
co-writers. Yeah,
yeah, yeah. Worked on that, but he's created out of his whole cloth Firefly, fantastic series that's still talked about. This is a guy that there are some people that get to create one thing that people fall in love with and talk about, but for a guy that gets to come in and originate, two of those franchises as well as other stuff, I'm going to say that you got to look at part of this, also Angel too and all that. You've got to look at it in the perspective of where a guy like J.J. Abrams, who was a well-known, highly recognized, talented writer, who then created Alias. It was very instrumental in Alias and in a collaborator on that. But then collaborated on things like Lost, and then collaborated on other projects and franchises and stuff, and has a bigger track record for, let me take this material or let me work with these other showrunners and create this sort of thing. So it's a different, it's a different skill set and a different temperament, maybe.
So if I'm reading a little bit between the lines, it sounds like, and again, yes, we're all fans. Joss Whedon certainly has an amazing knack for dialogue, and when it's a case where he has control over things. I remember a couple of those Buffy the Vampire Slayer episodes where, you always knew it was going to be a good one when it says written, directed by Joss Whedon, because that guy knows how to tell stories. But it sounded to me from the outside like there's a bit of a political game that has to happen, and that if maybe you're suggesting that J.J. Abrams is a little more familiar with the politics of compromise that go into that stuff?
I mean, I don't know if it's familiar or if it's just the role that he got. Like, J.J. Abrams' role is Kathleen Kennedy worked hard to get him to be part of the Star Wars franchise because I love what he did with Star Trek. I think the Star Trek films are fun. They're very, very fun. And I think that, he directs them beyond even the script. you know, I think that he pulls even more out than you would even, maybe be on the page. And she worked hard to bring him on board and to give him the kind of, to help him create this new universe. Where Joss Whedon is walking into the Marvel Brain Trust with Kevin Feige, who has done an amazing job of now creating what is probably the largest, most successful film franchise there is. And you've got to be a player with that, with people who are already saying, well, this is what we're doing. We're doing this, this, here, and here. And for a guy like Joss, you know, who's created Buffy, who's created stuff and is used to being the guy that gets to map that out, that's a different task.
Well, especially because and I'm gonna turn everything over to Justin here to kind of tell me the story. But from what I've heard, there was an awful lot of wedging things in that maybe he wouldn't have wanted to put in on its own, just because there's so many other pieces of the puzzle, so many other movies that it's like, look, you can't do Age of Ultron without some kind of clear indication that the Infinity War is coming. You must put a scene in, and I don't care how nonsensical it is that Hulk or that Thor decides to go take a bath in a cave in the middle of the battle scene or whatever.
Well, actually, I think it was almost the opposite way around. This is prefaced by the idea that Joss Whedon, who has been doing the press rounds for the Avengers 2, not odd, you know, does a lot of press because a lot of the press is sympathetic to him because they're fans of his work. Not odd. What is odd is the kind of tone that he has used specifically toward Marvel and the organization around the MCU. He has poked a few sort of sore spots, including the Edgar Wright situation that they had around Ant-Man, saying that the Edgar Wright script was the best script that Marvel has ever had in their hands, which is maybe a little bit even as an indirect shot at some of the other stuff that has been done, which I think has been really, really well, you know, as well received. He, as Brian mentioned, makes the comment that he didn't get paid much on Avengers. The biggest stuff is what he says to Empire Magazine in their podcast, and specifically gets into almost point by point the kind of stuff that you normally don't hear until maybe years after these projects sort of come and go, about the back and forth between him and Marvel and what he wanted and what Marvel wanted. And specifically, it seemed to center around Joss Whedon's insistence on the Hawkeye subplot, and specifically everything that happens in the farmhouse. Marvel did not like it, wanted to spend more time with the team doing Avengers stuff, and thus, because you didn't have enough time where you could more naturally work in hints and nods and explanation to the coming Infinity War, the way Joss Whedon described it, they basically put a gun to the farmhouse's head and said, either you add this scene where Thor takes, you know, hops into the cosmic jacuzzi and discovers everything that's going to happen in the next 5 years in the Marvel Cinematic Universe. Either that happens, or we cut the entire farm scene and we figure out some other way in reshoots to make this more clear.
All right, let's be clear. We're going to get into spoiler territory here, so we don't have to worry about that. Spoiler alert, spoiler alert, spoiler alert. I had fun. I had fun in the movie. I very much had fun watching the movie. Let me make that very clear. Go see it if you have not seen it, and then come back and listen to this. Go see Avengers 2. It's worth your time. You'll enjoy it. The farm thing, I'm going, all right, you've got this homicidal robot, this Skynet evil thing chasing after you that's trying to murder you, and you're going to take it home to your wife and kids? You're going to like, hey, guys, let's go here. Because it's like, it's not in the S.H.I.E.L.D. database. So I was like, and I understand it's a comic book, it's only that, but that was such a weird, weird thing to do, you know.
Full disclosure, the farmhouse scene I saw most of. That was my pee break during the movie. By the way, did you guys last the whole movie, or should that be part of the disclaimer, is you have to say what part of the movie you got up to run and go pee during?
No. I'm like a camel, man. Mm. I roll. I don't have problems like that.
I think I endured.
All right. Well.
I mean, listen. This is a hallmark of Joss Whedon's writing. Joss Whedon will always go. He will sacrifice the logical. He will sacrifice at times storytelling for the emotional. It matters to him that two characters interact and make emotional progress to bring the viewer in, which is, I think, so much of why people have a real connection to his writing, even if it means that maybe it doesn't make the most sense. He's willing to write that off in two sentences to
and
be
that,
like,
you know, that was, it's a movie I didn't want to get too analytical about. And I was about to like put a Facebook post like, oh, this is the Avengers movie where like the Loki scepter thing is used to make a scientist create some world ending thing that, you know, they should not be holding on to. And it's like, that's the first one. That's
well, and that's one. Yeah. And that's my biggest beef is that there was just so much that was familiar territory. And we talked about this. I understand that oftentimes the middle movie is the one where things get the weakest for the heroes that you love so much. That's where relationships are strained to the most. But given that was, you know, the inverse of the plot of the first movie. The first movie was all we did was watch the heroes fight, and then, oh, they came together as a team. It's like, it has not been long enough for me to be excited about watching them fight each other again. Personally, I would have loved to see essentially Ultron being the star of the movie. You know, let's see. Because they had, here's the problem, is the actual Tony Stark was an unsympathetic jerk, which again is setting up stuff for Civil War, and I understand that they have to meet to do that, but it's like, you could have taken all of that, taken that void and filled it with Ultron being the sympathetic Tony Stark kind of character until he goes too far. Make him an anti-hero.
There was something there, you know, that it was, and it's frustrating too, because it's like, listen, seeing Iron Man Hulkbuster fight Hulk is great, but seeing Hulk used in the same way the bad guy used Hulk in the first Avengers to throw a monkey wrench in there, you're like, we're to the point that Whedon has to justify why they keep the Hulk around, even though the biggest, most dangerous thing they have to deal with is kind of the Hulk messing things up. Was sort of like, we saw the Winter Soldier. There are more stories out there. You know, we've seen in Daredevil how you can do a smaller scale story that has like kind of almost like felt like The Wire, and you can get this, you can get a payoff, you can get this.
Can
we talk about this? Do you guys get the sense that, be it through Marvel talking about it or us secretly wanting it, that Civil War, the new Captain America movie, is being positioned as like, if you weren't satisfied with Avengers 2, there is another gigantic superhero get together. We get to see all these people interact with each other event next year or in 2 years, whatever it comes out.
I wouldn't discount it out of hand, but that's a bit too long game for me to believe they're playing on there.
They released a press release that had everybody in the Marvel Cinematic Universe, and it is a character list that I can't believe will be too much longer for the Avengers movies that are going to come out, with Infinity Gauntlet. It is directed by the same directing duo that the Infinity Gauntlet.
Maybe I'm misunderstanding your thesis. Is your thesis that they intentionally made the movie less good so that we would be excited?
I think it is now that it is like, Marvel makes the movies.
Oh, spin control.
And now they're like, all right, so if this didn't scratch your itch, like, we're going to go right back to that same itch. And look at this way, we're going to scratch it.
I mean, that's the other thing, too, is not only was it too soon for me to see all my heroes fighting each other, but it's all in service of saying, and get ready for even more of your heroes fighting each other instead of bad guys.
I don't care about them fighting each other necessarily. What I care about is, and this happened in both Avengers and Avengers 2, and let me also qualify, I liked Avengers 2 because I don't really expect much story-wise with my Avengers movies. Like, I expect them to go and fight a bad guy and talk to each other, and hopefully they don't invalidate what I loved about their standalone movies, where I expect more story kind of progression. Although, the further I get away from it, the more I'm kind of annoyed that we took this really awesome journey in Captain America 2, The Winter Soldier, about destroying S.H.I.E.L.D., and then, like, spoiler alert, with Ultron, Nick Fury just kind of has the entire like power of S.H.I.E.L.D. sort of like right behind him, including the like hundreds of people that it takes to run a helicarrier. And then they just go to a secret base that I guess isn't S.H.I.E.L.D., but kind of feels like everything we've known about S.H.I.E.L.D. before.
Yeah.
Like that kind of, the further I get away from it, I'm like, so are we still where we were with Winter Soldier? Because I really liked where we were with Winter Soldier, where, like, you know, we had to destroy S.H.I.E.L.D.
I think they're setting up Civil War. They need to have this thing in place for that to happen. And
there needs to be a competitive infrastructure. The U.S. government versus, you know, the heart of the individual
would be,
hero.
You know, I mean, it's unfortunate that there's not a really cool, exciting TV property that Marvel could do that could effectively bridge those gaps and get us excited about it.
I hear from, by all accounts, Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. got really good, but you disagree, so.
There are certain people, the same people who told me this were the people who told me other things that got better. And what they meant was it's not better, you know, it got rid of some of these weaknesses, but it never had any strengths.
But here's what I'll say about Civil War. At least there's a reason. What bothered me about Avengers, or if I'm going to really think harder about it, is that, like, you know, Thor spills a Coke on Iron Man, and now we have a 15-minute scene where they punch each other just so we can see things like Thor's hammer hitting Captain America's shield and Iron Man building an Iron Man armor that's hard, you know, that's big enough to subdue the Hulk, which is like fanboy service, right? It's the kind of stuff that wore thin for me as a comic book reader with like World War Hulk, which was pretty much only set up to be like, hey, let's see if superpowered Hulk could take down the entire Marvel universe of characters.
See, what's funny is I don't mind that very much because I loved my first foray into role playing games was not Dungeons and Dragons, it was Marvel Superheroes. So we used to do that. We used to go through the catalog book and just be like, all right, now it's Silver Surfer versus Scarlet Witch. Well, that was over quickly, you know. And it's like we would play these fantasy scenarios.
I guess, but like in and yes. Like, there's a reason why it's fan service, because it serves the fans, because you have an investment in it and you want to know what it looks like when they fight. It's just when you see them, when you see that over and over and over again, and you realize you only have X amount of time in this movie and you would like to see different things, I think it wears thin. And what I hope for with Civil War is, A, it's not – there might be like a few heroes fighting heroes. I suspect that the big long list of cast that they rolled out is going to be more – cameos, that we're going to get like a quote and a half from Paul Rudd as Ant-Man about what he thinks about something. And there could be fun sort of like, think more Wolverine in X-Men First Class. You know, I would hope that it is kind of that level of engagement. But at least there's going to be a whole story around it. There's going to be investment. There's going to be an idea of like, oh, do you fight for this or do you fight for this? And we can see both sides of the story as they play out.
I think I'm excited by the fact, like, you know, what the Russo brothers did with Winter Soldier, I thought was really, really tight. That they're taking over a big part of the Marvel universe is good. You know, James Gunn is good. And I'm very happy with where it's going. And I wonder, you know, is it, you know, I don't know, you know, what was going on behind the scenes with Whedon, if it was, you know, there wasn't the place for him that maybe he wanted in that.
You know, I think creatively he probably strained a little bit. You know, it is a team, you know. And it's funny because you mentioned he wrote, you know, he had a hand in writing the story for Toy Story. And, you know, one of the things that has kept Pixar afloat is the fact that they are a big collaborative team, and that they have.
Well, it's the system, not the people with Pixar.
Exactly.
They have the Pixar process.
When people want to lay down the law and draw a line in the sand, like the original director of Brave did, they are no longer the director of the movie that they, you know, had a lot of ties to, because that's how much Pixar respects. No. We need to, our brain trust says this is the direction you need to go. It is almost kind of anti-auteur in that way. They want to embolden the storytelling, but not at the expense of everybody understanding, well, this works and this doesn't.
Right.
And I was surprised when he was critical of the, when Whedon was critical of the Chris Pratt clip of him and Bryce Howard, you know, for the Jurassic World.
I hadn't heard. This is the first I've heard
well,
of it.
Well, you know, Whedon has done a admirable job of putting strong female characters first and foremost and making them the center of stories in that. And he was critical. There was a clip that aired and he said it felt like it was kind of like a sexist sort of whatever kind of thing, you know, which just looked to me like just two different personality types or whatever. And Pratt's the star of, you know, Guardians of the Galaxy, which is arguably probably the most beloved or one of the most beloved new Marvel properties that came out of nowhere. And you talk about people liking stuff and then loving that. And then here's a guy who's a big new Marvel star in a clip, and Whedon criticizes that. And he then retracted that, but it was just this. And then Whedon then got a lot of criticism for Black Widow is, you know, it serves the function of being a romantic interest and not having her own sort of narrative other than being manipulated by men, I guess.
Yeah, which is what was at least in the moment credited as the reason why he left Twitter. He gave an interview to BuzzFeed saying that it was not the criticism of people about how he handled Black Widow in the movie, although he then spent like three or four quotes talking about how people reacted to Black Widow in the movie. So who knows? I mean, he has a right to, we are not owed Joss Whedon on Twitter. You know, who knows what goes into it. If I were to take a wild guess, I would say that there is an amalgamation of a lot of different things. And also it's not easy to be in his role, especially since he has been publicly as sensitive as he can be.
And that's a thing where we don't know what constraints he had on the material, what he could and could not do, and where were he given the opportunity to tell the story he wanted to, where he would go if he only has a certain amount of time. This is how much Black Widow we get, and it involves relationships. And I think that's probably got to be a very frustrating thing. If you're like, well, if I could do the thing I wanted to, you would understand it and you'd like it, but I only had this, and so now I'm being criticized. And I can only imagine. I can only imagine.
Yeah. And beyond that, like, man, my name is Paul, and this is between y'all. If you know, you there for in terms of the feminist discussion of whether or not Black Widow was you know, treated unfairly in from a story perspective, it's not the criticism is not how I read the movie. Is all I will say. You know, I thought she was an extremely strong woman that dealt with, you know, a uniquely feminine problem and didn't seem completely destroyed by it. But you know, hey, listen, One dong, no vote when it comes to that kind of stuff, in my opinion.
Yeah. So what do you suppose? I get two questions. Pick whichever one you want. Number one, is there what can you read between the lines with him saying that he made more from Dr. Horrible than he did from Avengers? And number two, like, what do you suppose is next for him? Because now we're hearing, like, Star Wars rumors that he's going to go over to the Star Wars.
I put
no currency to that at all.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, Brian, there's only two things that the otherwise lauded Marvel Cinematic Universe machine has been criticized for. The contracts by its talent, most notably the actors, about not getting paid what they wanted to. And this is something that has ranged from petulant actors like Terrence Howard to very respected actors like Robert Downey Jr., who continues to have obviously a strong working relationship with Marvel, and the Ant-Man situation with Edgar Wright. And he made a point, whether or not it is just in the many points that he decided to make in free-wheeling interviews or it was more deliberate, that those were the two things that got traction, because somebody who was looked at as the creative head of the Marvel Cinematic Universe to a certain extent was poking both of those. So I don't know where his having someone who has read his blog, I am prone to think that he is somebody who goes on tangents, and this was probably stuff that just kind of came out in a stream of consciousness kind of way. But at the same time, I don't think that that's the kind of stuff that you just are telling to journalists unless it's something that you are thinking about and are a little angry about.
You know, and a thing to think about too is like where Brian and I, you know, you go through this thing where there's the way we see ourselves and we perceive our value now, and there's the way we perceive ourselves and perceive our value before we had our own TV shows, you know. And there's Andrew Main pre-A&E TV show, and, well, yeah, I'll do this or I'll do that or I'm worth this. Then there's Andrew Main after that, whose skill level is, you know, only increased tiny so much. But now, well, you know, they spent millions of dollars on this thing. So obviously, you know, you get this sort of, you know, sense, you know, and it's Joss Whedon, like, well, listen, four Avengers, your one film was Serenity. It lost $15 million, you know, fun, really good movie, really strong movie. You were not coming from a Michael Bay record of box office hit after box office bit box. People think, and we're right to think, that Inside of You was one of the top grossing films of all time, but you hadn't done that. And that's one of the things that Marvel's sort of done, is they've gone in and, you know, it's a model that used by Blumhouse Productions. You know, they'll go find directors who maybe are solid directors but haven't had huge hits and say, okay, we can give you a smaller budget, we can give you this sort of control. You know, and here it's a case where, you know, Whedon hadn't done film-wise big, humongous money-grossing franchises.
Yeah, and I believe there's a bit of unfair Hollywood math on the Serenity losing money. I think the budget was close to $25 million. I mean, I can't speak to the marketing budget, but I know domestic it made over $20 million, and I suspect it ended up pulling a profit international.
Remember, IMD says its budget was 40, which is estimated. Its gross is 25. You've got to have that. You got to remember, too, that movie theaters are not charitable things like churches. They take a cut of the stuff, and when you figure in, you double the cost of that. If it had made money, well, there would have been a two.
Which, by the way, second week of Age of Ultron was 77.2 million, less than the second week of Avengers 1, and you know, still gigantic. I mean, I think any movie in this day and age would die to have that be its second week grosses, but it is certainly performing under.
Yeah, it was, you know, that first week there was a lot of blame on the Mayweather-Pacquiao fight, because, like, in, you know, like, I know in Vegas, like, there was just nobody went to the movie theaters, and you look at, you know, that was one of the most, you know, biggest pay-per-view of all time, and an amazing thing, and the number of your biggest quadrants staying home. But that second week, and we saw that with the Hobbit movies. You know, the Hobbit movies, I still haven't seen the third one.
I have not seen any of them. I've seen one chase scene from The Desolation of Smaug.
Yeah, and you look at the Potter movies built to, you know, record-breaking totals. The first Lord of the Rings films built. The Hobbit dropped.
Yeah, but keep in mind also, we talked a bit about this on Cord Killers a while ago. Both Steven Spielberg and George Lucas have given talks where they feel like the age of the end-all be-all blockbuster is over, and that because of the diffuse way that we're able to consume all our medium,
But not much has changed since Avengers 1 came out, you know, and we've seen franchises go from Batman Begins, and the cinema scores were down, the critical reviews were a big drop from the first one, and so the word of mouth had changed a bit.
Yeah. Well, and also you saw rising grosses for Cap 2 from Cap 1, and like the unqualified Beatlemania of Guardians of the Galaxy, which I think is lost again, though,
like, I believe to their point, it's we live in the age of a bigger risk now, where it's like, if your movie can launch okay Friday night, but now more than ever, word of mouth and the reviews are going to slay it from week one to week two, or even, you know, from Friday to Sunday, which makes it less attractive for big studios. They can't muscle through something less than excellent nowadays.
Yeah. I mean, it's interesting, but then you look at a franchise. What's that?
It kind of makes you think that if you were a major motion picture franchise, what you would want to do is, knowing that that's the fact, get really cheap, underappreciated, yet strong writer directors that you can maybe pay less than even they made on their webisode series that they did with their friends during the writer's strike. So you can maximize the ability that, even if this underperforms to what we think, that the IP and a good application on it will get people to the theaters.
And you look at, you take a franchise
playbook.
you take a franchise that started off as a joke, it got bad, and then it got better and better and better, was Fast and Furious. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the last one did, you know, fantastic box office, wonderfully diverse cast. It broke the rules as far as what it was supposed to take to be a, you know, a hit, you know, and, you know, that's exciting, you know, and certainly is in its own way kind of like the Avengers model. Let's pull in all these name actors that you know and throw them in there. Where Expendables 2, which apparently wasn't as good as the first one, where Fast and Furious, you know, they've been, you know, just steadily improving it.
Speaking of which, Expendables 2 makes me think of Incredibles 2, which is rumored to have confirmed Brad Bird back at the helm.
Which makes you wonder how Tomorrowland's going to do. If they're not talking about a sequel, they're talking about his next animated movie.
Dude, I don't know. All I know is I loves me some Incredibles. It's probably my favorite Pixar movie. Maybe,
I love Incredibles. No, I'm excited.
It may be my favorite superhero movie full stop, because I can't name one better. Maybe the Avengers, and that's it. But,
I guess that's the thing. It's like, really, it's such a personal decision on something like that, especially in this kind of geek sphere. But, like, I wouldn't put the Incredibles in the same neighborhood as the Avengers. You know, like, I think the Avengers, I mean, that's, like, listen, everything we've said about Avengers 2 holds. I think it's better than Avengers 1. But I think that has more to do with what I expected out of the Avengers and what I thought of the Avengers 1 than anything else. You know, like, it delivered, even with a lot of just sort of glaring sort of plot stuff that was there, including, like, you know, do we, especially after now we've had another movie with him, do we really have any idea what the whole, like, I'm always angry thing was with the Hulk?
But they don't have to. That's the way it's always been in the comic books. The rules with the Hulk have changed over and over and over again. They did this whole late 80s, early 90s Gray Hulk era, where it was just, he was a werewolf and it came out at night. And he was more nasty when there was a new moon than a full moon.
I guess that's fine. Right.
Well, but that was, you know, was kind of like, there was a lot of cool stuff I liked in this movie. And, like, spoiler, the ending where he's on the Avengers jet and he's still Hulk, yet he's smart and he's not Rampage. I'm like, are we getting Mr. Fix-It? Because an interesting Hulk.
But keep in mind, it's not just the Mr. Fix-It era. There was a whole era where they full-on had him Banner smart as the Hulk all the time. He's like, yeah, I'm just giant and strong and tough and also as brilliant as Banner ever. And then there was always this Jekyll and Hyde. To be honest, one of the aspects I truly, truly loved about the Ang Lee's Hulk that, is universally reviled, I think unfairly so. But those moments when it goes into his mental state and he's looking in the mirror at himself, you know, wiping away the fog, looking at the Hulk, like that's what the comic books were all about, was this constant struggle, this chess match of, you know, you had this in these entire sequences where one character would build a trap for the other one mentally so that they could take charge for a while. I don't know that we need or ever will get resolution on the whole I'm always angry thing. That's the nature of the Hulk, because it'll always be a mystery.
Sure. And I have no problem with that being an influx thing. I think that it just, to me, is the grand definition of, like, does this make sense? And it's the pivotal part of the movie where, like, the heroes are down. It looks like they're losing the upper hand. And then the wayward son comes back and redeems himself. Like, does the logic make sense? I don't know. But it's really cool when Bruce Banner looks back at everybody and says, be-ba-dee-ba-dee-ba-dop, and then turns into the Hulk and leads the comeback that wins them the day. Like, that's really fun. That's what I like. I don't think that it's great storytelling-wise in a way that, like, The Incredibles was amazing, was like, drills down to, like, this very essence of, like, what superheroes are and how we relate to them and why we care about them. It is just like this canonical kind of storytelling about this, like, modern mythos, and I think it's just different. It's just in to me, it's on different planets.
Did you hear about Whedon said there was this really, really awesome thing that he wanted to put in there, but he couldn't put it in there, and they might put it in a later movie?
In the shot at the end when they're introducing the new squad?
What were you talking about?
The thing he wanted to put in there, but they wouldn't let him put in there.
I don't know what that was. What was that?
Well, here, you say yours and then
it's not that. It's not that at all. No. A scene like this would have been wonderful for, because basically the idea is that, you know, playing upon the idea of building up the idea of how much Ultron hates Tony Stark, Ultron starts beating up on Iron Man and bashing against Iron Man and getting, you know, just like, you know, in a final sort of battle, smashes apart the armor. Only it's Bruce Banner who then hulks out.
Wow.
Which,
that's pretty cool.
That would have been amazing, and it would have been exactly, because remember, Iron Man 3 was kind of the unofficial sequel to the Avengers, and it was the first time we saw a major focus of someone besides Tony Stark in the Iron Man armor. I mean, unless you count the War Machine stuff. But, like, you know, once you start seeing Pepper Potts in the armor or whatever, that would have been an amazing surprise. Or the drones. Surprise.
You know, there's that whole big fake out.
Yeah, on, sure.
You know, it's like, this is a fake out would have been, you know, that would have been like, you know, that would have been the ultimate crowd pleaser, is just the middle of it, you not knowing, and then all of a sudden.
Oh, no, that would have been.
That would have been, that would have been the moment, man.
Smashes Loki, you know, kind of moment.
Punching Thor, or yeah.
No, he mentioned in the Empire podcast that he wanted to include Spider-Man and Captain Marvel in the new.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. That
Avengers shot.
Yeah.
How about we don't just throw in Spider-Man? Like, how about we. You want to know what? How about since we scored the Hollywood coup of the century in terms of intellectual property? How about we build up to it a little bit more than just being like, oh, yeah, and he's part of the Avengers now.
All right. So, as we round things out, it feels like for completeness sake, let's just chime in on where our excitometers, our expectations are about Ant-Man and Fantastic Four. Because I can't believe I'm saying this, but after the latest, I would say judging just on the trailers, which is a not fair way to do it. I totally understand. But right now, the Fantastic Four trailer has me feeling better about the Fantastic Four thing than I ever seen. The trailer for Ant-Man didn't do it for me. But strangely, the posters, the one sheets, give me hope because, like, you know, they've got the hero shot, but he's like, you know, a half centimeter tall or whatever in there. Makes me think that Ant-Man is going to be a Guardians of the Galaxy style comedy dressed up as a action movie.
What? A Marvel movie that balances perfectly comedy and action?
Dude,
I've seen everything.
I thought I would have seen it with Age of Ultron, but that didn't happen at all.
No, it did not. Well, Andrew, you go first.
Sure. All right. Ant-Man is you leading into movies, you hear about, you get the idea, the buzz, and then maybe, you know, you text friends or people like that who are actually review and get advanced stuff, or you talk out here, you know, people are filmmakers to see advanced prints and stuff, and like everything I heard about Mad Max is it's like, you know, Tickle Your Testicles, amazing, fun, just crazy. It's that trailer is the movie big, and it's exciting. Marvel and people feel really good about Ant-Man. They feel really good about Ant-Man that they've hit it. And we had this, you know, Guardians of the Galaxy is one of these things where we're going, I want this thing to succeed, but a talking raccoon in a tree, you know? And then, you know, and the first time I see it, I love it. And I had little nitpicky flaws, but I loved the movie. I just fell in love with the characters and I loved it. I'm like, I get why they felt good about it.
Well, and also, Andrew, you tweeted out something the other day or yesterday that was like Marvel Phase 4 announcements. Oh. And it's all just like the title, the animated titles of like all these fake titles that are ridiculous. And what's amazing and fun about that is like, yeah, sure. Why not? Go see it.
The Jeffersons. Moving on up. So I have, you know, and like you look at first you're like an Ant-Man movie. And I love Edgar Wright. I was not excited to hear that he was. If you said, oh, Edgar Wright's going to go off and go make his own superhero film, I'm like, great. Fitting Edgar Wright into the Marvel universe, given the kind of movie he made, I didn't want to see that because I don't want the reality of that Marvel universe to break down. And so far, outside of like, you know, the TV show S.H.I.E.L.D., it is pretty consistent across the board. They did a wonderful job of first we get Iron Man. We get this thing. We're not dealing with, you know, Asgardian gods and stuff like that. We get this guy.
Dude, I swore I thought Thor was going to be a mega flop. I was like, how you sell me a Norse god? Come on.
And then they later, did. I'm in. I'm still. Those, where's the next Thor movie? I love it.
Those two movies really are underrated when you sit back and you watch them again, how I think how well executed they are. But so, you know, the Ant-Man thing, but then, and then, you know, so I was worried about it, right? Because, like, I don't want it to be like, I don't want it to be just a total cartoony kind of thing or whatever. I mean, I'm a big, I love Edgar Wright movies, but it was just, I don't want to see certain people I love jump into this other thing I love, because then it won't be the thing that I love. But anyhow, but then you sit back and you say, well, you know, it's got Michael Douglas in it. Michael Douglas is a great actor. Michael Douglas is really good. Paul Rudd is like, well, he's a little bit of a, you know, we're used to Paul Rudd, but he's like, no, Paul Rudd's a really good actor, you know, and then you start to, you know, analyze like what's going into, you know, Ant-Man and the parts of that there. And the thing that made it for me really, like, there was the thing when Edgar Wright was doing it, there was the little animated thing of him running along and jumping around, which don't sell me on a VFX shot. I don't want to see that. You know, what I want to see is sell it for me. But there's a scene in the trailer that really kind of sold it for me. And that's when, you know, he's fighting, was it Yellow Jacket or whatever? Yeah. And they fall, they're on the children's play set, and Thomas the Tank Engine is coming towards them, you know? And I'm like, oh, this is like Honey, I Shrunk, this is like taking Marvel into Honey, I Shrunk the Kids kind of, not necessarily humor, well, maybe a little bit, but just this other side of it, like, oh, it's going to feel like a very different place in the world. So I'm excited about that. As far as Fantastic Four is, I shouldn't let the rumors and stuff affect my opinion on that. I'm not feeling, I love Chronicle. Chronicle's a movie I did not think I was going to like. I loved Chronicle. And then, you know, it's hard when you hear like, well, you know, Disney asked him not to do the next Star Wars film, you know, that there was all this problems, the rumors of all that of going in to make the movie. I'm nervous about it. I want them to knock it out of the park, but I'm not feeling it.
There certainly was a lancing, it seemed to be in the press at the very least, the lancing of a boil of possibly some not good feelings about Josh Trank within the aftermath of the Star Wars announcement. Among them are that there are reshoots, or there were reshoots that he was like not even on set for, they have other people working on, because the studio, the Sony, doesn't have faith in him. And again, it's all rumors. Who knows? I will say that for me, you know, with my reporter's antenna up, all I know is that when people are running to reporters and saying stuff, or reporters know a lot by rumors, and then when something that comes out to corroborate it allows them to go back to sources and say, hey, what about this? What about this? What about this? That means that kind of falls under smoke, you know, equal fire territory, in my opinion. I don't have a ton of hope for Fantastic Four, which is just such a bummer, because I love this cast so much more than I liked, you know, the previous cast. I think Trank is a very capable director, although it remains to be seen how much I loved Chronicle was his direction and how much was, you know, the Max Landis script. But we will see, you know. I hope it's cool. You know, you want to know the first thing that gave me a weird a tingle about Fantastic Four? You know who the composer is on it?
Composer?
Who's doing the score?
No.
Philip Glass.
Oh yeah. That's awesome.
And it's like, all right, now I can dig on some Philip Glass stuff here and again, right?
Sure.
And you know, here's the thing too, is that like Marvel is willing to go do, you know, the bread and butter Avengers movies, you know, give us an Iron Man film, you know, to give us these sort of stuff, and then take a flyer on a Guardians of the Galaxy or an Ant-Man. You know, that they're willing to, you know, sort of, you know, when they first announced Guardians of the Galaxy, it's like, you're taking the most obscure property in your entire thing, and we're not getting a standalone Hulk film, we're not getting these other things, and you're doing this? Well, they knew what they were doing.
Dude, that's what gives me faith. That's what, like, yeah. I will be so fast to eat my own words
You know, there are three. The three, if you look at like ratings wise, like audience approval, like the three weakest films were, you know, obviously the Hulk, which was good, you know, which was you know, the Norton Hulk,
Incredible Hulk, right?
Yeah, Incredible Hulk. Yeah, not in the MCU, you know, which was a solid movie, but not the levels of the other ones, and has the problems of a Hulk story. Like Thor, like the second Thor or whatever, which I loved. I mean, I enjoyed that one. I really liked that. Iron Man 2. You know, which just was problematic in many ways. And then this Avengers, you know, other than that, all the second Avengers, you know, are like the four least, you know, score. And they're all really well liked, but that's there. And then, so then you start thinking about some of the more out there sort of stuff, you know, the fact that, you know, Guardians does so well. So,
I mean, who knows? That's, to be honest, maybe the most exciting thing out of this whole conversation is that for all our talk, all three of us, I think, are very quick to admit that if we were having this conversation a year ago, speculating in the same kind of space, we would have been wrong, eight varieties of wrong. And
about what, Brian?
I mean, certainly my speculation about Guardians of the Galaxy.
Oh, like, yeah.
I mean, there was no way that thing was going to be amazing. And it was.
And to me, I think that might be my favorite Marvel movie.
Full stop. I don't blame you, man.
Like,
yeah, I think that between that and Winter Soldier, you know.
And two kind of different flavors that sort of share the same playbook. But like, yeah, I mean, like, it's just it sits with Star Wars on my iPhone of things that I can watch a half hour of at any time to kill time on a plane. Yeah. Like, I just, it doesn't matter where I'm at. I'm always getting to the next thing. I love every element of it. I still laugh at the jokes. It's so fun.
Yeah.
Yeah. We've had 11 of these movies now. 11 of these movies.
Insane.
You know, that arguably probably the worst one was Iron Man 2, you know?
Yeah, but I can't let that be because it has a cameo from Elon Musk. So
I mean, I still have fun with the movie. I still
let's also For purposes, can we separate Iron Man 2 into the first hour of Iron Man 2 and the second hour of the rest of Iron Man 2? Because the first hour of Iron Man 2 rules. It is so fun.
Yep.
And then Whiplash.
Oh, there's a lot of fun stuff in there. Yeah. And, you know, so, and what are we getting next year? We're getting Civil War. We're getting Doctor Strange.
Thumbs up for Doctor Strange, for sure.
You're not excited about Civil War, Brian?
I'm afraid it's just more of what we just got from the Avengers. And what we got the most of in Age of Ultron is now my least favorite thing. It is a parade of people with underdeveloped storylines who fight each other without a lot of context or reason. And I that's what Civil War looks to me to promise to bring us more of. So I'm less excited about it than ever.
Yeah, I guess that would be where I guess my anticipation for it differs from you, Brian, is that like I think, and this is again my conspiracy theory, I am reading motivations into actions, which is the worst thing in the world. But I think what Marvel is trying to say is like, no, this is going to be superheroes getting all up in each other's business, but it will be for a reason. There's a reason why this is all happening in a way that it's not just like, you know, oops, you touched me and now I'm going to fight you because like it's awesome to fight for 10 minutes.
Yeah.
Well, I understand your hesitations about the story. I'm excited about the storytellers. I agree.
And again, I could go on blind faith. It's just that,
Daredevil.
It's keep in mind just a week ago, you know, I saw a parade of characters, and I complained about this on Cord Killers. Like, War Machine's entire arc in Age of Ultron was how he wanted to have a good story. And then the funny part is, when he was thrilled that he was finally going to have a good story, as a viewer, I was like, this story's kind of crappy. You just kind of are shooting some random stuff. It's like,
I guess, I don't know. To me, that's an all right cameo arc, though, for a guy who has three movies or three scenes in a movie and one of them's a VFX shot. Like, you know, that's fine. I don't know.
Okay. But I'm just afraid that we'll just
that's the least. I'll tell you what. I was delighted with what they did with War Machine. Not so much what they did in terms of almost everybody else in the Avengers in terms of bringing them from point A to point B story-wise. In fact, I think there's more in those two scenes with War Machine of him being like, you know, all of a sudden realizing the difference between hanging with the Avengers of telling a story to Hulk and Captain America and having them yawn and then going to some random group of people and realizing that he's a badass and then becoming one of them. There is more in that than what I got out of almost everybody not named Hawkeye and Black Widow.
Yeah, there are, you know, and it's funny because, like, there are points where you kind of, like, I've said this before, it's like a Spike Lee film where parts go, it's great, and then you're sort of the Spike Lee part of it is, like, gets in the way. And, like, Whedon is sometimes like that where there are so many great moments. I mean, I love, like, you know, after the first battle, you know, they're like, oh, tell Bruce how good of a job he did. Like, oh, your enemies are screaming. You know, Thor's like, oh, your enemies are crying in the depths of hell and da-da-da-da. And, like, Bruce Banner's terrified of us. I mean,
yeah.
You know, he's got to walk it back into like, unharmed. They're non-dead. You know, you didn't kill anybody.
Well, and I would say real quick, Justin, that keep in mind, you know, Romanoff and Hawkeye are in a unique position in that they don't have their own movies. You know, the only development they'll ever get is as secondary characters in these other things. So it didn't bother me at all.
Well, I mean, Romanoff she's effectively part of the Captain America franchise.
Yeah, yes. But again, we saw her not as the primary character, but no. Yeah. Well, of course, she got introduced in Iron Man 2, right?
She did.
Yeah. And she was a great, and that was a great, like, I loved the inner, I mean, like, you know, you think about, here's the thing to think about. In Winter Soldier, you had Captain America, you had Nick Fury, you had Black Widow, you had the Falcon, you know, you had four characters, you know, four
well,
big
and,
kind of,
and plus all the bad guys.
The Bucky turn and all that. So you had like that was like in a
Gary Shandling. Let's not forget Gary Shandling.
Yeah. Yes, exactly. Hail Hydra. It didn't feel crowded. It really didn't feel crowded, you know, between, you know, they were done right, they were used right, and so I liked that. Oh, and you know, and like a great cameo from Bruce Banner. I'm sorry, Tony, I fell asleep.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, I'm thinking of Winter. I'm sorry. I'm combining my favorite movies together.
All right. Well, look, man, I got to call it, guys. We're up on an hour.
Well, it's been after.
The Diamond Club hopes you have enjoyed this program.